I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Like to spend some time talking about the bad boys on the world block, Russia and Iran. Russia has been kicking up a lot of dust over the last, I guess, few years, ever since Putin has come into power and stayed in power, even though he was a shadow government there for a while. And, of course, we know the situation with Iran. But what are, Jim, what are the interesting connections between Iran and Russia?
Well, they are both failed states. And they both had revolutions which promised all sorts of positive changes. And in both cases, the revolutions failed. I mean, first it was Iran. The Ayatollah Khomeini came back in 1979. He had been hiding out in France, where the French like to give asylum to potential revolutionaries. And he overthrew the Shah, who was an unpopular dictator. Sound familiar? And the basically a democracy was promised. Now, this is something that most people don't remember. You know, we're old farts, and we remember this because we were there at the time. In the that period, the 1980s, two things happened. One, the religious parties, the religious groups, which the Ayatollah had united with non-religious groups. I mean, these people were Muslims, but they weren't organized in a religious sense, but just in a purely political sense for a democratic Iran. They agreed, and this is a matter of public record, they agreed to form a democracy. Not a religious dictatorship as they have now, but a democracy. Then Iraq decides to invade because things were a little chaotic. And most of the Iranian oil is near the Iraqi oil. And, of course, the Saudi oil. I mean, it's all one huge system of pools of underground, you know, oil. And the population in the Iranian oil territory is predominantly Arab. They're Shia Arab, but they're Arab. They're only a few percent of the population, but they happen to be sitting on where the oil is. And Saddam thought he could march in there as a liberator, a fellow Arab and a Shia, no religious differences, and say, hey, we're going to liberate you. Now, relations between the Iranian Arabs and the Iranian Iranians, the ethnic Iranians, had always been a little, you know, rough, but they got along. And Saddam was known to be a bit of a whack job already. And he had two strikes against him. And when he was young, he started out to be a lawyer, then he became an assassin. You know, so, I mean, you know, his subsequent behavior is probably explained by that. The invasion went terribly wrong because the Iranians immediately stopped bickering among themselves. There were still royalists around at that point. Everybody snapped to fight this foreign invasion, which Saddam didn't anticipate. Well, this led to a 10-year war, actually, which ended in mutual exhaustion. And in that greater chaos, the religious the senior clerics like Khomeini, who had basically been a caretaker government when Saddam invaded, they declared, managed to get people to agree, all done democratically, to agree to a religious dictatorship. And that's why we now have a religious dictatorship. They promised all sorts of things they never delivered. Iranians are getting tired. Now, fast forward 10 years to 1989 and 1991, when the Soviet, the Eastern, the communism collapsed, as did the Soviet Union, Putin, among many other people in the KGB, were, and we forget this, they were among the brightest, you know, cleverest, not always best educated, but they were very sharp people. That's who the KGB went after, sharp and loyal to Russia. You know, if you met those two qualities, you had a great career as in the KGB because that was the place to be. You could, for example, you could only be arrested by a fellow KGB officer. You were, in effect, above the law. So the Soviet Union collapses. Everybody talks about democracy. They have elections. Of course, the only people who know how to politic are the Soviet officials. Yeltsin, this guy Yeltsin, who had a drinking problem, but hey, he was Russian, you know, so that was nothing surprising. And he gets elected, but there's chaos because everybody has a different idea of how things should be run. Western advisors are flown in and they add to the chaos in some respects. And finally, after almost a decade of this, Putin gets elected. And what people noticed, well, some people in Washington and other places noticed, was that he basically started as an aide to Yeltsin, made himself very useful, which is not difficult for a KGB guy to do because they're selected as people who can get things done, everything except save the Soviet Union. And he basically said, well, all right, I'll get myself elected. Now, you got to remember, the KGB did see this coming. I mean, they basically admitted this. In fact, the last couple of, except for Gorbachev, the two guys who preceded him were ex-KGB, their senior people. So the leaders of the Soviet Union, they knew, the KGB knew what was really going on, but for decades they ignored them. You know, they were warned that, you know, you got to make some fundamental changes because we're losing the people, the economy's going into the toilet. And they said, don't worry about it, you know. And the KGB felt that they could, if they had control, they could make it work. They didn't in the 1980s because these two guys died very young, apparently of natural causes. It's just one of those things. And then Gorbachev was like, you know, the perennial, compromise candidate. You know what he did. Anyway, so Putin gets in, and he quickly apprises the situation and realizes what Russia needs is a dictator. Well, no, not a dictator, a strong man. There's a difference. You know, the Russians have this term, several words like Eskimos and snow, for a strong man, a stern ruler. They respect that. It's a cultural thing. And Putin basically presented himself as such. Now, he's a relatively young guy. I mean, when this all started, you know, he's when the Cold War ended, he was like in his late 30s, a junior, so to speak, KGB officer. But like I said, most of the KGB guys, the senior officers, were very capable guys, and he basically recruited a lot of them who were now out of work. And he said, look, I think we can save Russia. Now, this is important, too. They were doing it for the best of reasons. Granted, they turned out to be thieves and what have you, but they were patriotic thieves. And again, that makes a difference because they are righteous. Just like the Shia cleric in Iran. In fact, the KGB, so to speak, Putin and his crowd embraced God. They rebuilt, cathedrals historical cathedrals that Stalin had ordered, torn down and turned into parking lots. I mean, he just did a lot of things he knew because the KGB did constant analysis, surveys, as it were, the public pulse, as it were, throughout the Cold War. Throughout the Soviet period. So they knew what was actually going on out there. It's just that their bosses wouldn't listen. Sounds like Wall Street in 2008. But anyway, the end result was he managed to reassemble the Soviet-era police state in the guise of a democracy. Russia is still technically a democracy. They have elections, but he basically legally, using the laws, the power to make laws and what have you, he changed the laws to make it easier for one person, one party, or one coalition of parties, as it were, to remain in power indefinitely, which is why he's been in power continuously since, 1989, he got elected, 1990, and you're only supposed to be the head of the Soviet Union for, 8 years at a time. But that was the kicker. But also, then he basically became prime minister in between. He had his boy Mendeleev, be president for 4 years, and then he came back and he's doing a second date. I mean, this will go on indefinitely until he dies. But the point was, he is very popular within Russia because, like the Soviets, the communists before him, he's making a lot of promises. He's hitting the right notes, which the communists were very careful to do early on. That's how they got in power in the first place. They said the right things. They knew how to basically take advantage of mass media. This is something that they were among the first to glom on, onto in a political way. And they were very successful. Unfortunately, they were running a bloody dictatorship. And unfortunately, they didn't allow elections. So the guy who came after Lenin was a paranoid, mass murderer, Stalin. So Putin, who is not a mass murderer, but a very clever guy, but basically an autocrat, in other words, what I say goes. And he's running the country into the ground. For example, we did a piece today in Strategy Page where I pointed out that by Russia's old statistics, since they invaded Crimea, Ukraine, last year, 2 million people have left Russia. Now, about 1 million people have entered Russia since then. Russia is in recession, so there are fewer jobs. Almost all the people who have left, well, half of them were foreigners, Eastern Europeans, from the people from further west and what have you. It's basically technical people, auto executives and what have you, getting out because Russia has suddenly become a very inhospitable place for foreigners. So the Putin's invasion, shall we say, of Ukraine has not only had several hundred billion dollars of money from Russia, but they've had 2 million, of their most capable people, half of them Russians, and more are getting out every day. And half of these have been replaced by refugees from Central Asia. Now, some of them are ethnic Russians, but a lot of them are just, Central Asians, who the Russians don't particularly care for. But they do have some jobs that have to be filled. But you can't fill, an electrical engineer's job at a street sweeper. A guy whose last job was herding sheep out in the steppe. So they are running into some real problems, which Putin doesn't even want to hear talked about publicly. And he knows about it privately. But the fact is, he's running the country into the ground. Going back to Iran, the Ayatollah, they did the same thing. They promised all sorts of things after the war is over. And what has happened after the war is over? Things continue to go downhill. They have sanctions on them for all sorts of stuff. They're basically an international pariah. Right now, the latest round of sanctions makes it difficult to sell their oil. The Saudis are at war with them, a war that doesn't get talked about too much, but it's a very real war. It's Saudi Arabia cutting the price of oil right down. The Saudis are said to have made a secret deal in the 1980s to do this, in conjunction with the United States, in order to bankrupt the Soviet Union. Now, nobody's ever provided evidence, but that's actually what happened. One of the reasons the Soviet Union collapsed was economic, and that was the low oil price, which was maintained because the Saudis had the largest supply of oil, and they are the only country who by themselves could basically put control the price of oil up or down. That's one reason why our United States and the West is very cooperative with the Saudis, although the Saudis have a lot of things going against them. They're also a religious police state, but a more benign one than, say, Iran or, some of the other alternatives. The end result is you have two empires here, Gog and Magog, who both, Russia used to be nice towards us, but now they both are accusing us of being the authors of all their problems, have declared themselves to be, their primary enemy, and they are basically on a course towards self-destruction. And, of course, one has nuclear weapons and the other one desperately wants to get them, which is not a good thing, because Putin in Ukraine, in response to all the sanctions, he was basically saying, hey, if you push too far, I might use my nukes. So we have a terrible situation here, which is not likely to get better anytime soon.
Austin? Your comments on Russia and Iran and...
Well, one of the things I'd pick up on, Jim described them as failed states. They're both highly corrupt states. Their politics are corrupt. Their economic... their economies suffer greatly from that. Some of the sanction regimens that were initially haphazardly opposed and then ultimately strengthened that began to work targeted elites that had been escaping some of the penalties of the earlier, more generalized sanction programs. These are these targeted sanctions against specific organizations and individuals. That's That's, they were less effective until, as Jim pointed out, the Saudis began waging oil price war, and then that began to bite. The reason I point that out is that you don't see much in the at the headline level coverage in major media of Iran and Russian corruption. You will see it about when the comments in major media about the Russian oligarchs are around Putin, but those corrupt the corruption is the corruption is one of the oddly enough one of the strengths of the way both the regimes operate. If once you're part of that inner circle, you get the goodies. At the same time, it causes potential political, actual real fractures within the country. The Green Revolution, which erupted in June of 2009 in Iran, was spurred not simply on the lack of civil rights, but on the crookedness of the Iranian regime, which to put it in the security framework that you were you're asking about, Dan, and pick up on some of the themes that Jim raised. These are brittle regimes. They're failed, but they're brittle. They have a strength that is based on their ability to cause trouble internationally and threaten, and as Jim said, a key to what Putin and his pals do in Ukraine is, hey, you push us too far, we have nukes. That's why the Iranians want nukes. One of the reasons. They may have a theological or a view of the end of history, an eschatology for getting the nukes and wanting to use them, but there's also that regime maintenance element. We have the nukes, so don't mess with us. Don't topple us. You know, there's only so far you can push us, which gets into the way that the Persian Gulf Arab states and Israel perceive the Iranians. Would the Iranian government, based on its past behavior, use nuclear weapons offensively? They'd certainly threaten it to do so. And that is what brings us to the, I know, the moment of what is to be done about Iran's quest for a nuclear weapon.
Right. Now, Jim, Russia and Iran have not historically been allies. What are they doing currently in concert to stir trouble up?
Well, they're supporting each other diplomatically. I mean, Russia is in a very powerful position in that they still have a veto in the UN, which only five countries have. And this goes back to the founding of the UN, and a lot of countries want that changed, but so far that hasn't happened. They also are one of the second largest nuclear arsenal on the planet. But yes, historically, Russia and Iran have been enemies. they have several simmering disputes over Azerbaijan, which used to be owned by Iran, then it was independent, then the Russians took it, et cetera, et cetera. They both consider themselves empires which have been treated badly by outsiders, in this case, you know, the West. And they have these resentments which, you know, leaders in both countries have capitalized on. I mean, a lot of people in Russia and Iran realize that there's more to be gained by cooperating with the evil empire of the West than continuing to try and fight it. And of course, from the Western point of view, this is especially true with many Russians and Iranians who live in the West. They tell their people back home, he says, you know, people here don't even care about Russia and Iran. I mean, you know, our home country, you know, the old country, is a backwater, considered a backwater. You know, they'll help out, but they have no interest whatsoever in conquering, you know, Russia or Iran. And, you know, people in Russia and Iran are coming more and more to agree with that because they're being pounded with this propaganda, you know, from in both Russia and Iran. And the leaders of Russia and Iran, they understand what's happening, that they're fighting losing battles, you know, against the future, as it were. So they have more to gain by cooperation than trying to resolve ancient feuds, which I'm sure they'll get back to, you know, at the first opportunity. But right now, so to speak, it is not an opportune time. So Russia helps Iran by building nuclear power plants, by selling them weapons. Now Russia is apparently, from what they've said, they're going to break the arms embargo, which they have scrupulously, you know, well, they had to be yelled at a couple of times, you know, to stop them from selling advanced anti-aircraft systems to Iran. But now they're saying, no, we're going to sell them seriously. We're going to do it this time. That remains to be seen. The Iranians helped, ironically, by helping Russia deal with the Islamic terrorism problem. Russia can have a much worse Islamic terrorism problem internally if it were not for the help of Iran. Iran knows a lot more of what is going on in the Islamic terrorism world than they share with the West or anybody else for that matter. But they share with Russia because Russia is a valued ally, a valuable ally, just like the Iranians share with China. I mean, there's all this trading going on that is never going to be seen, perhaps by our grandchildren, you know, in history books, when stuff starts to come out. But those of us who have studied the past, you know, can just, you know, extrapolate forward and say, oh, I see what's going on here. This looks familiar. So they're basically in bed because they have to be. It's the only place where they can stay warm and survive together. You know, politics makes strange bedfellows, and this is a perfect example.
Austin, address a little bit more this brittleness and having nuclear weapons. How has that stirred up the other states in the Middle East?
Well, look, there's a push me, pull you. In other words, this is when I say they're brittle, they've got great internal strengths and ability to repress, but their corruption and their brutality seeds revolt against them, seeds disenchantment. Some of it gets hidden or subsumed when they play on nationalist themes. I mean, Putin is always playing heavily on Russian nationalist themes, you know, seizing Crimea, greater Russia. I mean, some of this stuff sounds right out of the 18th, 19th century ideology of the Russian czar, and the theocratic dictatorship still plays on Iranian, Aryan, I mean, they're the land of the Aryans, the Persians, beliefs, historical faith in what the Persia being the center of the world, that's 500, 400 BC, and they're still relevant, and that at least the myth is, and they use those as a way of at least perceptually diminishing the resistance or in internal disenchantment with the regimes. They also use their nuclear weapons. That fits in, the nuclear weapons fits in, Dan, with their, hey, we've been wronged, but we're back. We're a major player, and we can threaten all of our enemies with nuclear destruction. That's part of what I mean. They're brittle, but if they get to have nukes, and I mean, Putin uses that as a threat to Europe, Central, Western Europe, to NATO, and it's at the same time when you pull that nuclear sword or threaten with it, people get very, very serious. The Russians are not prepared to nuke their customers because where they get their wealth is out of, you know, selling oil and oil and gas to Europe, somewhat to China. The Iranians, see, the Iranians don't have the nuke yet. And part of the brittleness of it is that they have stirred real fear in the Persian Gulf, Arab states. I mean, Dan, over the last 3 months, there's been a lot of reporting, and just reporting things that on Strategy Page we've been talking about since Strategy Page started in 1999 about Persian Gulf Arab fears of Iran. Well, those are old historical fears of being overrun and dominated by the Persians. So, at least on the Sunni Shia divide, the Iranians are Shias, so there's that that component as well. And over the last 3 months, you've had reports of senior ministers in various Arab states, and including one of Saudi Arabia's senior defense ministers. He may actually, now I think about it, I think he's in intelligence right now, saying, "Well, we would be considering what would happen is that there would be a number of states who would, if Iran got a bomb, who would consider arming themselves." He was a little bit more opaque than that, but that's what he said. There's also been reports, and this has happened before, of quote-unquote convergence of interests between Persian Gulf Arab states and Israel, because Israel is threatened by Iran. In fact, this is regularly, you know, the Iranians, what was it, 10, 12 years ago, a senior Iranian official called Israel a one-bomb state. That's a direct threat. And part of what, you know, we're recording this after the recent Israeli election. Part of what got Bibi Netanyahu reelected was the perception within Israel that he's a better leader to deal with the Iranian national security threat. I consider the speech he gave to the U.S. Congress. He's out there, and he despite all the pre-election hoopla about how weak he may or may not have been. In retrospect, coming to the United States and making that speech played very well to getting him reelected in Israel. But the reason he's reelected is because of the perception of the Iranian threat.
Jim, Iran continues to push money into Hamas and some of the other groups there in the Middle East. Does Russia do the same thing, or are they, I guess with their, what they're doing in the Ukraine would sort of maybe be considered similar to that. Are they funding other groups besides the Russian minority there in the Ukraine?
No, that stopped when the Cold War ended. They used to be a major supporter in terms of training and weapons and other equipment during the Cold War for all sorts of terror groups. Most of them were non-religious, but that ended with the end of the Cold War. And as far as anyone knows, it hasn't been revived. What Russia has done is they've expanded their special operations, you know, their special forces, commando forces, what have you. And they have, with the new SVR, which is the successor of the KGB, actually the KGB was separated into a domestic and a foreign. The foreign SVR part of it, now has a lot more people assigned to special operations, you know, overseas. And these, yes, these will use, you know, local hires or people recruited locally. But the CIA does the same thing, so they're not much different. It's not the same as supporting, as the Soviet Union did, you know, training and what have you, specific terror groups. The Russians basically are confining their overseas adventures in this department, you know, with recruiting locals to what they call the near abroad. In other words, former parts of the Soviet Union that are now neighbors of Russia, like Ukraine and Georgia, and there's a few others, the Baltic states. All these countries, including apparently Poland, are seeing a lot more activity by Russian espionage, you know, elements, as it were. Now, all these countries are very hostile to Russia and to the establishment of a new Russian empire at their expense. So they have been very cooperative. many, like Poland and the Baltic states, have actually joined NATO as an insurance policy against being reabsorbed into Russia. So we know quite a bit, because these near abroad countries still have a lot of knowledge and some contacts, you know, of how Russia operates and within Russia. So they have been a very, very, very useful source of intelligence on what the Russians are up to. And what they are basically up to is trying to, you know, start subversion among ethnic Russians in these near abroad countries. That's why they went after Crimea, which is more than half, I think over 50% ethnic Russians, and a specific area, the Donbass, two provinces in eastern Ukraine, which are not quite as much, have the highest percentage of ethnic Russians. They're still a minority in that area, but the highest percentage of any place in Ukraine. But it's interesting to note that even in the Donbass, the majority of ethnic Russians do not want to be part of Russia, because they see Russia for what it is. You know, it's like during the Cold War, if you wanted to meet a really informed and dedicated anti-communist, talk to somebody who had lived under communism. They knew what they were talking about, and they hated it, the whole concept and practice of communism. So the ethnic Russians living in the near abroad, some of them are willing to go to work for Mother Russia, usually for some consideration, as it were. But most of them are realize that, you know, they're probably better off if they can find a job somewhere else and not have to deal with, you know, any new Russian empire.
Yeah. Austin, one of the things that was floated by the U.S. administration with Iran was that Iran could be used to as a hammer against ISIL. I find that humorous. Do you find it humorous that they would even think that that was possible?
Humorous isn't the right word, Dan. Politics makes strange bedfellows. There's a convergence of interests in getting rid of ISIL. ISIL represents a violent, radical Sunni threat, and certainly Iran is one of their ultimate enemies. It gives Iran an opportunity, unfortunately, to strengthen its allies within Iraq, the militias that were really actors for the Iranian special forces inside Iraq. That is extremely worrisome that the United States would bless that. There are ways that the problem is what do you do after ISIL is licked? And I think that's what is going to eventually happen. ISIL's created too many enemies. The one read on this is that, okay, we're letting the Iranians and the Shia militias take the casualties around Tikrit. Now, that's pretty cynical, but okay, if they're willing to do it. You let them take that, and then the Kurds come in with a counterattack from the north, and you at least eliminate most of ISIL's presence in northern Iraq. But then what obtains once you have this Iranian army? Is it really the Iraqi army now, or is it an Iranian army inside Iran? That isn't humorous. It's disturbing. You can understand some of the thinking behind it. Do I think organizing a militia effort, given the need for reorganizing once again the Iraqi army, but a militia effort, and including, you know, armed Shia militias that with Iranian sympathies within in Iraq to push ISIL out of Tikrit, is an option. It's something the Iraqi government, you make the case, it had to do, but with Iranian advisors. That's the mistake there. Look, the big mistake in Iraq, and we've talked about it on Strategy Talk before, was the complete withdrawal of U.S. security presence. That left a vacuum for the crookedness and parochialism in the Iraqi government, Maliki becoming totally Shia actor, and the Sunnis losing what they saw as their political protector, U.S. presence. So we had a situation where you would be building an effective Arab ally right in the center of the Middle East, Iraq, but it fell apart. And now the Iranians are back, and of course they see the Tigris and Euphrates as being their front yard, and should be under their control anyway. So.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch how this all plays out, both in the Ukraine and as Iran puts more pressure on Iraq and continues to develop its forces there. It looks like those are going to be two sore spots for a long, long time, and Russia and Iran are going to be on our radar, and it seems like we almost talk about them every other time, and neither of you see that ending, correct?
No, it's not. They've been a problem for a long time, and that's not going to change anytime soon.
Right. It seems like it's going to require Austin. It seems like it's going to require some deftness on the part of the Western governments to deal with these two entities.
Well, it's going to require more than deftness. It's going to require strength to act. You can't sit there. Well, we're going to negotiate this and we'll negotiate that and we'll allow this and we'll allow that. You do have to have a firmness that says no more, and you back that up with action. You're seeing stirring of backing up at least the Balts and Poland with action by running elements of an American mechanized infantry brigade in through exercises in Poland, and also I believe it was I forget which army unit it was, but exercising in one of the Baltic nations. But to firm that up, you're going to have to strongly consider. I would do it. I've recommended doing it. Basing permanently a garrison of an American armored brigade group in Poland in Warsaw, and the Poles middle of last year were screaming for us to do that. They wanted 10,000 American troops, and that's why I thought, okay, that'd be the support structure, and you'd have an American armor brigade forward deployed. That is what you need to do, and you need to be serious with the Iranians saying, you get a bomb, it's going to have consequences. And we've talked about that, what those consequences should be. I refer listeners to go look up, go to strategy page, go to the search tool, and check out SSBS. No, it's not BS. Simultaneous Strategic Bombing Strike. A little short article Jim wrote in early 2003. Now, he was looking at Iraq, and he was. But that is something that the U.S. Air Force and Navy have been working on. And, Jim, would you call that time on target at the strategic level? That's what it is.
Yes, so, and it's one reason the Russians continue spending a lot of money developing air defense systems.
Yeah, well, that's a way. Go read it, folks. But basically, could Israel knock out an Iranian nuclear the Iranian nuclear program? My guess is yes, but it would be on such a slender thread. The U.S. can't guarantee that it could do it, but with some of the what we could do with an initial strike and the things that we could erase and crack, we've got the tool to do it with conventional munitions. So the Iranians know that, but the United States government needs to constantly remind the Iranians of that.
Jim, one last question. We'll wrap it up with this. Is there, I mean, back in the 70s and 80s and even the 60s, we threw around a term, realpolitik. And is there anybody in the West that is currently practicing this other than the Israelis? Do we have anybody that really understands the politics and the force structures of everything that's going on with Iran and Russia?
Well, yes, there are people in most Western countries who understand this. The trouble is it's a political issue, not a just let's understand it issue. And you basically, in each country, have to play with a lot of special interest groups. For example, immigrant Muslims are now an important player, especially in Western Europe. So knowing the right answer is not the same thing as applying the right answer. Everything has to go through politics. And politics, as one American politician once wisely observed, all politics is local. So you basically get, no matter what the strategic truth is, carrying out an action against that strategic truth or to deal with that strategic truth all has to go through, local politics. And this is why any answer from the West, which is all democracies, sounds like a cacophony, a chorus that can't sing, the same song in the same tune at the same time. But, that's the price you pay for democracy. As Churchill observed, it's a terrible system, but it's better than all the others.
Right. Well, we'll end it there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, Dan.
Till then.
Bye.